I want to read you the Psalm of David that David read. He really took ownership of the Psalm, didn't he? It's a Psalm of David regarding his experiences in the cave, a prayer. And this is what he says, Psalm 142. I cry out to the Lord. I plead for the Lord's mercy. I pour out my complaints before him and tell him all my troubles. For I am overwhelmed. And you alone know the way I should turn. Wherever I go, my enemies have set traps for me. I look for someone to come and help me, but no one gives me a passing thought. No one will help me. No one cares a bit what happens to me. When I pray to you, O Lord, I say, you are my place of refuge. You are all I really want in life. Hear my cry, for I am very low. Rescue me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison so I can thank you. The godly will crowd around me, for you treat me kindly. That's David's psalm. Now, I don't know about you, but I know about me that there have been times in my life when I have been so troubled and so much in distress that I became completely self-focused. And even if there had been someone who saw my distress, my self-focus was so great, I was unaware of them. It's like David said, I look for someone to come and help me, but no one gives me a passing thought. Ever felt like that? Like, you know how much trouble you're in, but nobody else can even see it? And if they do, they don't care? That's what he says in the very next line. No one will help me. No one cares a bit what happens to me. I don't know about you, but in those times when I've been there, and I've been in some pretty desperate places more than once, hate to admit, remember a time when I had 4 cents, literally 4 cents to my name, and my rent was $85, and I had no job, and no way to make my $85 rent that month.
Only once.
Only once, yeah, this happened more than once, but I remember the time I had 4 cents, because I remember it because I couldn't even buy a pack of gum, which was a nickel at the time. I didn't even have enough for gum, much less food or rent. And there have been other times in my life, as I'm sure in every one of our lives, when things have been really, really tough. And one of the things which is characteristic of most of us, I suspect, me for sure, when I'm in one of those places, I am so self-focused. First of all, I don't think anybody notices. Secondly, I'll be damned if I'm going to tell anybody how much trouble I'm in. Maybe literally. And third, I think I'm the only one that's ever had this problem. And nobody else could understand even if I explained it to them. This is so stupid, I don't even know where to start. But, hey, I've been that stupid many times, probably will be again. And yet, look at David. This is written 3,000 years ago by a man who suffered just as we suffer today. By a man who, at the beginning of his prayer anyway, didn't think anybody even noticed. No one even took notice of him. He says, no one gives me a passing thought. And there's no one there to help me, and no one cares. That's what he says. And I know I've been in that place, and I think probably all of us have been or are in that place. And sometimes when we're in a place like that, maybe we do actually pray. But the prayer, I think, seldom is as explicit or as heart-rending or is there as much grief poured out as David did when he wrote. Rather, I think sometimes our prayers are more like, gee, God, things are really awful. Please help me. And I think sometimes even when we pray that prayer, it's sort of half-hearted, and we don't really expect anything to happen. We don't really expect him to show up or do anything. And I think also, when he does help us, we often miss it. Or we attribute it to something else. Circumstance, or happenstance, or coincidence, or my own ability. And there's an old joke, which probably at least half of you know, so bear with me while I repeat this joke if you've already heard it, but it illustrates my point. There's a little village in a valley near a dam, and the dam bursts. And so the warnings are sent out for people to abandon the area lest they be drowned. And a car comes driving along, pulls up to this house where they know a man is living. They honk the horn and they come out and they say, the dam has burst, there's a flood coming, hop in the car, we'll get you out of here. And he says, not necessary, God will protect me. And so the car drives off. The waters start to come and the water starts to rise around the house, and a boat comes by with rescuers in it and say, come on, hop in the boat, the dam has burst, you'll be drowned. And he says, not necessary, God will protect me. Waters continue to rise, they're up to the roof. He climbs up on the roof, he's sitting on the peak of the roof, and the waters are up to the top of the house, and the helicopter comes, and they drop a ladder down and say, come on, climb up in the helicopter, we'll rescue you. And he says, not necessary, God will protect me. And the waters rise and he's drowned, and he finds himself in heaven. And so, madder than a wet hen, he goes to God and he says, I don't get it. I'm supposed to trust in you. You're supposed to protect me. And I trust in you and ask you for protection, and I drown, and here I'm in heaven. It's okay that I'm in heaven, but I didn't have to drown. And God says, I sent a car, I sent a boat, I sent a helicopter. You didn't take any of them. Okay, now, it's a good joke, but it illustrates a really important point theologically. We have to be open for the ways God will help us. And sometimes it is absolutely miraculous divine intervention, and it comes in ways which are inexplicable, and they violate all rational thought. They violate the laws of physics. I mean, sometimes the help is in that form. And other times, the help is through the people of God. He rescues us through our brothers and sisters, and we don't notice. And we don't even acknowledge that it's Him that's at work. And part of the problem is that He would desire to help us through our brothers and sisters, but we're too proud to let it be known that there's anything wrong or that we need anything. Pride can be an awful thing. Not just the kind of pride that a rich or successful person has in his or her accomplishments, but also the pride that keeps us from revealing our need or even asking for help. And I think sometimes the reason for that is because we make bad decisions. Sinful decisions, sometimes just dumb decisions, and we get into trouble. Sometimes it comes because the modeling that we've had in our lives hasn't been good. It's one of the consequences of living in a society where the divorce rate is as high as it is. When I counsel couples who are considering marriage, it is very often the case that both of them come from divorced families. Occasionally the case that only one comes from a divorced family. It is rare that both of them come from intact families where mom and dad are still married and together. And so what model does this couple have as to how to deal with trouble when it comes in a marriage? Because it always does. Every marriage has trouble. It's the nature of human relationship. If the model you have is from parents who have stayed together and we work our way through it, then I promise what comes out the other side is stronger and richer and deeper than anything you've ever experienced up until that time. But if the model that you have from your parents is, there's trouble, let's get out of here, let's walk away from it, then not only do we not develop any strength of character at all, but we set the same model for our children. And that curse gets passed down from generation to generation. And that's the model that we have in our society today. Things get bad, you run away. It's not just in marriage. Everywhere, things get bad, you run away. You don't face into the trouble anymore. We don't, I don't. It's not the model that we have in society to face into the trouble and work through it. But we know that if we do, we come out stronger and wiser. And so, maybe there are bad decisions that we've made in our lives, and one of the things we don't want to reveal is those bad decisions. And so we're not going to ask anybody for help, lest they should discover that I made sinful decisions or dumb decisions or whatever. And so, that pride which hides our bad decisions keeps us from getting wise counsel from those who could teach us, if we are willing to learn how to make better, more godly decisions. But first we have to confess our pride and give it up. There are many areas of my life where I am not competent to make good decisions. I just haven't learned how to do it very well. And if I try to make decisions in those areas of my life anyway and press on and not admit to anybody that I'm not so good at that, guess what? I follow up. And consequences result. If, on the other hand, I'm willing to admit my ignorance, willing to admit my inability, and seek counsel from someone who I know is skilled, who has demonstrated insight and ability and wisdom in that area, then I can avoid those follow-ups, which are almost certain if I do it without wisdom. It's one of the reasons why one of the major sections of the Bible is called wisdom literature. And if you read wisdom literature like Proverbs, line after line after line is wise counsel from a wise man who is giving us guidance on how to make decisions in life. But we have to confess our pride. We have to be willing to expose our bad decisions in order to be helped. And the truth of it, for every one of us, is that not one of us is without needs. Not one of us. Not a person in this room, certainly not me. Not one of us is without needs. But pride keeps them from being met because we hide them. We don't want people to know what they are. We might be embarrassed. People might think less of us. And so we don't get help. Remember the prodigal son? Now, I've talked about this before. It's such a wonderful story that Jesus tells. Because here's this son who asks his father for his inheritance, which is a lot of money. And then he goes out and he blows it all very fast. I mean, this is a huge sum of money. And he blows it. Wastes it on stuff that he never really needed for life, but he wants it anyway because it entertains him or makes him feel better or makes him feel more successful or who knows what. Not even his own wealth. He was given to him by his father. And he blows it quickly until he is so poor that the only job he can get is working for a pig farmer feeding the pigs. That's all he can do. And not only that, but he's got to live with the pigs in the field. And so he sleeps in pig slop. And he says at one point that he wished he ate as well as the pigs did. Finally, he has so little left that he's willing to give up the pride of his father discovering what he's done with all of the wealth that he had. He's willing to let his father discover how far he has fallen. And he decides what he'll do is he'll go back to his father. He won't say, "Restore me, Dad, make me your son and wealthy again." He instead says he'll go back to his dad and beg him to let him just be a servant in the household. Not even his son anymore, just a regular household servant, because he remembers that the servants eat better than he does. He's sleeping with pigs. And so he gets up out of the pig slop and he heads home. Finally, he gave up his pride. And he heads home. And what does his father do? His father doesn't stand there waiting for him to arrive so he can berate him and lecture him about how stupid he's been and how foolish he's been and how he has wasted everything he's been given. His father doesn't do that at all. His father, as soon as he spots him returning, the father runs to the son and embraces him. It says in the Greek, he fell on his neck. It means he did this. The father went like that to the son, just dropped his head onto the son's neck and embraced him. And Jesus tells that story to tell us how God thinks about us. God is not standing with arms folded, an angry scowl on his face, ready to lecture us as soon as we turn back to him. The story Jesus tells about the prodigal son is just exactly so we understand that that isn't what God is like. God is the one who runs to embrace us when we are willing to turn back to him. And then Jesus also teaches us in one of the most important bits of Scripture in the New Testament. When someone asks him, what's the great commandment? And Jesus says, there is one great commandment, love God. And there is a second which is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. He says, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. One person in a story asked him, well, who's my neighbor? And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. In another case, Jesus talks about the king, meaning, in this instance, himself, and how people who served others who were in need were, in fact, serving the king. And they say, well, how can that be? And he says, whatever you did for the least of these, you did for me. You help somebody who's down on their luck. You help somebody who's in jail. You help somebody who's ill. You help somebody who's broke. Anytime you do that, you are serving, I am serving Jesus. And so in a sense, what Jesus has done is he's taken these two commandments, love God and love your neighbor as yourself, and they've become a single insight, which is when we serve our neighbor, when we serve brother and sister, when we love brother and sister, we are loving God. That's what Jesus teaches when he says, when you help the least of these, you help me. Love God and love your neighbor are really a single commandment expressed in two halves. Now, would anyone in this room, anyone, raise your hand, would anyone refuse a request from God for help? If God said, Steve, can you help me out over here? Would you say, you know, I'm really busy right now, can I get back to you next week? Right? I've done that, he says. Raise your hand. Right? I think that the reality is that if we really had an encounter with God and he said, I need your help in this way, we would, all of us, I think, be ready. We'd want to do that. And yet, look at what we're doing. Follow me here now. Look at what we're doing. If I'm in trouble, I have emotional need, or a financial need, or a job need. I just need some prayer. Whatever my need might be, if I am too prideful to tell you about my need, I am robbing you of the opportunity to serve God in me. I have basically said, you know, God may desire for you to serve him through me, but too bad, I'm not telling you. So you don't have that opportunity. I've stolen it from you by my pride. Here's the bottom line. This is what church is about. It's not about buildings. It's not about traditions. It's not about getting things exactly right in ritual. It's not about singing exactly the right hymns for exactly the right length of time. It's about serving God in each other. It's about loving God in loving each other. That's why this family of God was made. That's why Paul says that we are all members of the body and we are to serve each other. Jesus is the head of that body. Jesus desires that we be his hands and his feet in the world in serving those that he loves and in bringing those who are outside of the kingdom into the kingdom and loving them. That's what church is about. It's about the family of God. It's about supporting each other, helping each other. It's about making each other aware of our needs. It's about knowing that every single one of us will fail in some profound way, many times in the course of this life. And we can either hide it and put on a stiff upper lip and pretend like everything is okay and go on living in a very superficial, hypocritical way, or we can just be honest with each other and blunt and let us know when we're in trouble. Me let you know when I'm in trouble and need prayer. We've got to do that for each other. We've got to throw away that pride that keeps us from doing it. And we've got to give each other the opportunity to serve God in each of us as each of us needs help. And so we all know that we have needs and we need to express those needs. We need to help and support each other. We need to love Jesus in and through each other. We need to hold each other accountable. We need to help each other make good decisions. We need to seek godly counsel. If there are things that I just don't know how to do very well because I haven't had a good model in my life, I need to find somebody who's good at it and say, please give me your wisdom. Help me through this. I don't know how to do this well. I screwed it up last time. I don't want to do that again. I want to do it well this time. Give me your counsel. Hiding will never heal a damn thing. But being honest and forthright with our needs allows them to come to the light and allows the light to meet those needs. We need to turn back to God and turn back to the family that He makes so that family can gather around us and love us, so that He can love us through each other. This is not to say God does not come in supernatural ways in individuals' lives, because He does for a fact. But He also desires that it be normative that He loves us through each other. Listen to how the Psalm 142 that David wrote ends. After he has said, no one will help me, no one gives me a passing thought, no one cares a bit what happens to me. He says, then I pray to you, O Lord. I say, you are my place of refuge. You are all I really want in life. Hear my cry, for I am very low. Rescue me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, so I can thank you. David was not in a literal prison when he said this, by the way. So this bring me out of prison can mean a spiritual prison, a mental prison, a financial prison, a physical prison. It can mean any of those kinds of things. And then listen to this last sentence of Psalm 142. The godly will crowd around me. In the Hebrew, it's encircle. The idea is that those who are in the family of God, when I cry out for help, God will meet them because the godly will encircle them, will crowd around them. And then he says, for you treat me kindly. In the Hebrew, it says, with bounty and reward. And so David realizes that when he turns back to God, that what God then does is he brings the family of God to encircle us. And all of the help and the support that we need comes from that family of God. But first, the pride has to go in each of us. First, the pride has to go. We have to be willing to admit, to cry out for help, to be honest with each other. And when we are, then the love of God can flood through the family of God and lift up each of us when each of us is in trouble. May this be on each of our hearts, Lord. May it be compellingly with us. May we desire nothing so much as to love you by loving those that you have made. And help each of us to cast away that worthless pride, because nothing of you happens as long as it stands in the way. Amen.